The Weekend Podcast on Vox Markets with Justin, Peter and Steve. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast. It's the Weekend Podcast. It's a bit later than normal. I'll explain why in a bit, but Paddy's in for Pete on the podcast. Pete, apparently. Welcome, Paddy. The podcast you've been on before, of course, and Steve is there. Steve's at his boyfriend's house in Bristol. Is that right, Steve?
Well, I wouldn't say my boyfriend's house, but my friend's house, yes.
Well, he's a friend. He's a boy, isn't he?
Yes, in that case, he's my boyfriend.
Hey! All right! And Paddy's here. Right, Pad?
All right, Justin.
Yeah, I was just saying, Steve was talking there because we were talking about batteries and iPhones, and we know, right, that Apple, pretty much, they give updates, and they slow down your battery, and they said, it's to preserve the battery. It wasn't that. It coincides a couple of months before a new update comes out, or a new phone comes out, doesn't it? So they want you to buy a new phone, because that's their business model, pretty much. They ship millions of these things, about 70 million of them every quarter. And Steve said, it's quite easy to change a battery. You buy a battery, Steve. It's very easy to do. How much is the new battery? And it helps the phone, doesn't it?
Yeah, it depends on what phone you got, obviously.
iPhone.
Different models. different models use different batteries. But I did the 6 recently, and that was £17 for a genuine Apple battery.
And usually they come with little screwdrivers as well.
Well, yeah, I think it's like they usually like charge you an extra pound for the little screwdriver kit. Once you have them, that'll do all the iPhones. So
what about though, if you've already got a small kit from a Christmas crackers, you know those little screwdrivers you can get? I got some of those. I never used them yet from Christmas. They're tiny little screwdrivers. I'm thinking, what do you use these for? They're ridiculous and tiny.
You might have a use for them.
Yeah.
iPhones.
Exactly. The reason why we're late, Pete's doing a cycle ride for breasts. That's what he said. He's in Cardiff area doing a cycle ride for breasts. I think he means breast cancer. So round of applause to Pete there for doing that. That's why he's not on. Paddy, if you've not heard the podcast before, started investing recently. He's a lot more advanced than Steve. and Steve's been at it for years. But the reason why it's delayed anyway is because I had a call last night from Theresa May, and she said, listen, we're doing an airstrike tomorrow. Now, I wanted to cover it on the podcast because I want this maximum. Have you seen her? Have you seen her appeal today on the telly? She says, I'm also doing a news. Have you seen that, Steve? Have you seen it this morning? Our Prime Minister talking about it? Have you not seen it, Paddy? Yeah. Have you seen it?
No.
Haven't you? No, she's basically justified. Are you aware there's been airstrikes overnight?
No. I do now. About an hour ago, I noticed it on my feed, but yeah, I didn't know at first.
Paddy, you've not noticed there's been airstrikes overnight in Syria?
No. I haven't watched the news today.
What's hang on? I've been in a fully blown debate on Twitter for the last 2 hours. It's happened. Trump, Macron, and Theresa May, they've done tactical, targeted airstrikes on chemicals weapons factories in just outside Homs in Syria, apparently. And I like the fact they were targeted rather than just shoving bombs everywhere. They mentioned the word targeted several times. I assume that, But I first and foremost, right? The people are complaining, saying, well, she should have got parliamentary permission. Cable and Corbyn are whinging, and they should have got parliamentary permission. And she's going to go in Parliament on Monday because they come back after recess. And if I was her, and she's going to get a lot of flack. If I was her, I'd say, shut up, Corbyn, will you? I'd say, I'm the Prime Minister. I don't need your permission to send our boys out dropping bombs. When you're up here, when you're the PM, when you're the big person in control, you can send the military out too. Now, just pack it in, right? Wind it in, Corbyn. I love the fact that... Go on.
I was going to say, it just seems like Corbyn, whatever Theresa May says, he just says the complete opposite. It doesn't matter
what he says. Well, he's the opposition.
He should test that and just try making some things up and just see if he just does the opposite.
Yeah, but he's the opposition, that's it.
He didn't seem to agree on anything at all. Sometimes parties do agree, but literally he objects and says the opposite to everything she says. So.
I know, I just think literally they take that word too literal, the opposition. And you're right, everything they say, that this picture is black and white. No, it's not, it's red and blue. Oh, right, well. And let's go to stocks. Paddy, Steve, have you been looking at the markets this week? Anything about the markets you've struck your fancy? Go on.
I've noticed that BT are slowly creeping back, aren't they?
Yes.
Great news. Yeah.
It's odd, isn't it? And even against what's happened and all the trade tariff wars and the market has been, it's been a very tough market. Paddy, you've started, right? sort of investing or getting a bit more active in the investing world when the market has been very hard. It's like we are, you know, almost trudging through custard in concrete boots. You know, it's hard work. It's like we're going, it's very steep up a hill. But yeah, it is hard at the moment, really hard. It's tricky. We're not getting any momentum behind it at all. But yeah, BT is slowly, hasn't it, coming from oversold. And I mean, look at the chart now. The last little spike it had on the chart is it got 246, 245, I think it closed, and then went back down. So it'd be nice to see us get above that. Where are we at the moment? We're at 241. So if we can get above 245, which was the last little sort of high of the last few weeks when it had a rally, then I'd be very bullish. And then, but Paddy,
where does that end up then? Because that was the first stock that I bought.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went through the whole process of trying to understand how to buy shares with that one. And now I'm sat there, it's up for me because I got in at like 220 something. I'm now thinking like, okay, cool. Do I sit on that for 5 years and just leave that there as a sort of longer term investment? Or is there a quick win to be had there? Is that money better invested somewhere else in a smaller company that would have a more bigger chance of exploding in terms of price?
Yeah, well, good question. Very good question. Hard to answer, but do you know what? You are going to get a return on BT. If the trend changes, and we don't know, there's no confirmation yet, and I was chatting on the weekend, you've WhatsApped me about charting and technical analysis, you know, and you said, is it really dark art and really, you know, fanciful? And I said, a lot of it is. When you get down into Fibonacci, especially on smaller stocks, I don't really believe in it. In fact, even last night on Twitter, I had a little chat with someone, and I said, listen, this is how I use charts. And I say, fundamental analysis is when you study, you know, the actual news about a company, their balance sheet and all that, look at that. That's helps you find what to buy. Charts help you find when to buy. You know, so you find the company first, what you'd like. There's a good story. It's, you know, look at the valuation of it, think it's undervalued, and then you use a chart to fine-tune your entry. And that's where you look at previous highs. If it's spiked up, avoid. If it's a big spike, avoid it. You know, if it's in a downtrend, and BT is in a downtrend at the moment, and you can say what
still
you want. Yes. I mean, it is, because it's been going down since 2016. And I mean, there's what's called 200-day moving average. And if you're not aware of charts, that's basically a line formed by every closing price over the last 200 days. And you know, and it's not been above that. It's not closed above that since 2017. And so once it gets above that, close above that, that's when the trend has changed. And once that 200-day moving average flattens out and starts curving around, that's when the trend has definitely changed. I mean, of course, it may pop above that and come back a little bit, but I think, yeah.
But surely everyone watching that chart can spot that as well, and would that not automatically then, I mean, the price suddenly goes up?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, listen, there's in bigger stocks, there are algos. You know, there are algorithms, there are traders that work off algorithms, and they would scan for all companies that would be, if price would be closing above a 200-day moving average. So that would help the momentum, you know? And definitely. At the moment, you know, they won't even be coming up on people's radars because it's in a downtrend. And and likely, you know, they would also get algos looking for companies finishing below a 200-day moving average for the first time and say, okay, that's a possible short, you know, selling it down situation. So, yes, at the moment, and then when you see that short closing as well, so you get two bits of action there. You get people closing their shorts on the stocks, the trend has changed, and people buying. So that would be in double momentum there. And so when a stock starts to rally, it's like an oil tanker. It's hard to stop. Once it starts to change direction, you know, it's hard to stop it. It keeps going further and further than you think because you get momentum behind there. And it often goes beyond, you know, true valuation of a company. So you get all these analysts coming out saying, oh, BT should be around £3.10. You know, literally, if it gets through £3, it probably goes £3.60, £4, because the momentum is there and you can't stop it then. So people don't price that in. Analysts just look at raw data, you know, and things. So, see, but I mean, at the moment, the 200-day moving average is at 266. It's still coming down. So as the price comes up, we're at 241, the share price, that will still come down. So it's sort of meeting the middle-ish. So I think about if it gets over sort of 258, 260, something like that, maybe 255, probably that, it's looking good, I think. And if it stays above that, that's looking good.
So what's your plan with that one? Because you own that as well, don't you?
Well, we had a little experiment. We've done this experiment with big stocks, because we're all into small stocks, me, Pete and Steve. But this was, we decided to do, what's it? Steve, it's been so long we've been in BT now, I forgot the title of the experiment. What's it called?
Was it it was £100,000 we're trying to make, isn't it? 50 trades or less to 100,000.
Yeah, start with £1,000. If you make 10%, apparently, and compound that, roll up, you get 100,000 in 50 trades or less. And it will be less if you do. And we've done quite well on the first two. We've done like 21% on Sky, which is double our target. So obviously, it makes the trades will be less, that means. And we've done about 13% on EasyJet. I think it was the first one, then Sky. We rolled it over to Sky. Then we rolled that over to BT. But it's just, BT's been a nightmare for us. We bought it £3 initially, about £3.06, I think it was. And it went down to £2.27. But we're sticking in.
10% on £3.06.
We did scale in, though, a bit lower. So we broke the rules of the experiment. Because that's not... do you know what? I argued, and Pete argued with me, saying, you're just breaking the rules of the experiment. I said, experiments are about, you know, changing and reacting to things, you know? That's what experiments are about. If you input one thing and you get the wrong thing out, you do a different... You put something else into it, put different inputs. That's all about experiments. But that's the way I buy shares, though. I scale in, you know, and it's a very...
I think Pete's argument on this was the fact that, fair enough, we can do this when we're quite low, but if this starts working and we start getting higher up in the trades, we won't be able to average down that much, because the stakes are obviously going to be a lot higher. To average down is going to be almost impossible.
Unless we'll have to put more money in,
thousands of pounds in the bank, now, but it won't work in the long term.
Yeah.
So do you have, with that in mind, this probably leads on to another question I was going to ask, do you have lots of automatic trades set up within whatever app you use? So when BT hits the price you're looking for...
No, I don't actually. I don't have any limit order or a stop order. No, I don't. I mean, I don't know. I'm still down in it. I'm down about 15% at the moment, I think. Steve, what are you at, Steve, on BT?
So I average down quite a lot at, I think, 245. So yeah. I think when we go over that, I'll probably be breaking even. So anything over that, then I'll be in profit.
No,
so
I think you bought lower than that. Oh, no, okay. No, you're probably...
No, it's about...
All right,
it was about 243, actually, I think it was.
But the rule is, Pad, when the person who's down the most gets 10%, then we all cash out. I think that's the rule, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah. Well, no. What we do is when it hits 10%, we put a stop loss. So then, at least if it continues to rise, we don't lose out on the rise. But then if it then drops, it sells out automatically.
I can do a trailing order on Barclays. I know Harry and Larry Lansdowne there don't do that, do they, Steve? So essentially, I don't know what that is, Pat. It'll follow up. So you can say, for example, sell this stock if it drops by 30 pence from its high. So it'll keep going up and up and up, and the trailing order will follow it up 30 pence below the actual share price. If the share price comes down 30 pence, it'll trigger a sell. So it'll follow it.
No.
So, you know, it's the kind of thing. Okay.
Harry and Ali don't do that.
Yeah, no, don't do that, Larry. It's too complicated. That is. Oh, don't want that. No. What are you talking about? So anyway, that's BT. But I think we're yet to see confirmation here of a bot. Nicola Duke has been on the chart saying, buy BT. I said, you should never say that ever, because, I get the odd idiots blaming me for, you know, them making bad mistakes in trading. And I've got, in fact, let me just say that right now. If you listen to this podcast hoping to get a tip on a stock without doing any research and hoping to make lots of money easily, you're an idiot, okay? And you're going to lose money. That's it, full stop. You will lose money. Do some research. It's your money. Treat it like a business. Treat it like it's your business. You know, would you go into business like a bike shop or something like that without doing any research whatsoever? Some people would. But would you do that, or would you open a hairdresser's without knowing anything about hairdressing whatsoever? Just start up with a scissors in your hand and say, come on in, I'm starting the hairdresser's. That'd be quite good, actually. Imagine people going out with the haircuts. I've never cut hair before in my life. You know, chatting to them in the mirror. Anyway, on holidays? But that's the same kind of thing, isn't it? People think they come into trading. You wouldn't think you could do that in tennis or anything else. People think they come in investing and trading or whatever and just do it. You know, think it's easy or just copy someone. You can't do that.
I certainly wouldn't ask advice on hairdressers for you as well, Justin, because you've got no hair, so definitely wouldn't take advice there.
But what's your thoughts, Pad? You've been sort of more actively investing. What's your thoughts on it at the moment? Are there anything that stands out and you think, oh, hang on, this, I didn't understand that, or, you know, or that was new to me? Or is there anything you think initially that you can think, you know, initial lessons you can share with people?
I think, the first lesson I've learned is that I wasn't investing enough money, which probably sounds a bit daft, but I wasn't putting, so in terms of like the percentage commission and the costs in terms of each trade, like I started off with like £250 and £500 and stuff, and the percentage of the commission and the charges on top involved with that means that actually any gains have to be dramatically higher to pay for the trade in and out. So that was something that I should have done. I wish I'd put more money into some of the smaller stocks that I initially bought, like Upland Resources. I put in a tiny amount of money there, and I wish I'd put in more at the start, because that seems like a decent story. Yeah. And now I've got this sort of this view of the price at the moment, and it did well on Friday, didn't it? Where I know what I paid initially, and I've got this sort of I'm nervous to pay any more than that, which is a ridiculous way to look at it, because the story of the company seems to be pretty positive.
My rule on this, right, is like, if you know the story, and it's a very simple rule, is try and buy on a down day if you know the story of the company, and try and sell if you want to sell on an up day. And there's several reasons for this. I mean, if you're buying on a down day, it probably means that the exciting news that is, you know, that like Upland, we'll talk about Upland in a minute, but the exciting news has been released, and there's all people jumping in there going crazy. And it's, you know, it's a seller's market. You can get sell your stock at a premium then. Everyone's jumping in, you are buying it at premium. And so that won't happen. It'll come back after a couple of days, you know. It may rise a bit higher, but it'll come back and you can probably get a better price than you would. So, you know, it's always good to do that. Try and sit back, you know, resist the fear of missing out, and just sit back and think, right, okay, let me do some more research on this. And and Paddy, there'll always be the case of, you know, on winners thinking, oh, I should have put more in. On losers, you think, I should have put less in. So that'll always be the case. But what you've got to do is try and realise, you know, what percentage exposure you've got to one company as a percentage of your portfolio, you know, a value, for example. Now, like I say, I always try not to go over 10%. I do sometimes, if I think a company is very oversold, I think I do more research than the average person. So, I know people who do go way over 10% exposure. So I'm quite safe, keep myself quite safe. So I never want to bomb one stock. But that'll always be the case. But always try and do that. Always try and buy on a down day and sell on an up day. If you've done your research in a company, you like it. Because that means, you know...
Also not being afraid of hindsight as well, I think. Like, you know, prices are always... The whole idea is it's going to go up, ideally. And if you've got a bit of extra cash that month and you think you can... If you think that share price has still got some movement in it and it's going to go in the right direction, then... You know, if it goes from 2p to 5p, it's still as good as if it went from 1p to 4p. That doesn't make any sense, but you know what I mean.
There's a lot. I mean, with small caps, you say they're always going up in the long term. They may not, but there's a certain caps. When you look at small pre-revenue stocks, which we dabble in it on AIM, these are companies that go to AIM to raise money. That's their essential job. They can raise money via issuing shares. That's a currency, you know, it's money. They wouldn't get, there's this fallacy or this thought that people think small caps, you know, they do these fundraisers and they're a discount. And they think, why have they done a discount? They blame the company. You can't blame the company for that. That's their only option. They have to raise money. They have to go with a begging bowl in most cases when they're a beat up company, a small cap company, you know, a couple of million market cap, and they want to raise a bit of money. They have to, I mean, the only incentive lenders have is that discount. And so they can't just go to a premium or anything like that. So they can't go to the bank for a bank loan. Banks won't even lend, you know, a high risk. You're talking about an explorer or, you know, a drug company, very high risk, super high risk, and they haven't got any revenue. You know, lending money, you try and borrow money if you're in that situation. If you've got no revenue, you're exploring in something like Africa, or you're looking at a very cutting edge technology or exploring a drug or something, and you try and raise a bit of money. It's very hard. You know, it's the people lending that money know it's very high risk and they charge for it. So it's very risky. So, I mean, like I say, when you're looking at the small cap companies, make sure they've got enough cash to take them through the next milestone, at least. And that's, you know, when I look at my model of the cash model, that's in there. Because if they haven't, they'll have to raise money. And they'll, in the market, people will know they're going to have to raise money. Just look at the balance sheet, look at the interims or full year statement. People will know they have to raise money, and that will provide downward pressure on the share price all the time. And that makes it worse for them to raise money then. Because they know they're under the cosh and they have to raise money. So make sure they've got cash. And I've done it several times. I've jumped in too early on stocks because I have fear of missing out, which had a little rally, and then all of a sudden I found myself 20% down, 25% down, because they need to raise cash and they're dragging it out. So, yeah, with small stocks, you know, non-revenue, non-profit generating companies always make sure they have cash for at least, you know, 6 months or a year, hopefully, until they pass the next revenue milestone, because otherwise they're against it. Yeah. Anything else I want to chat about? A company I bought this week that I'm very excited about.
Go on.
And I'm going to say that, listen, this is not an incentive for you to buy anything. People, if you're listening, just say, do some research on this company. I'm very interested. And I'll tell you why. They're breaking the mold. Now, I try to explain, Pat, early on, you asked me about, there's three areas, isn't it? There's three areas you should look at. If you want explosive moves in share prices, three areas. These are resource stocks, and that's oil and gas and mining. There's tech. Because, of course, you know, future technology can shape industry. So that, for example, like a Fasari into this, or EVRH, you know, VR technology, because people don't know how big it can be. It could be massive. And there's also biotech, like little pharma companies. Now, the company I bought this week is called C4XD, and they're in this area, but they've broken the model, the business model. And I'll tell you what the traditional model is. So you get a small biotech company developing a drug, and pretty much small companies, all they do is they generally have one lead product, right? And they may have another product, they may have two or three, but generally all they focus on one, because they haven't got the money or resources to help look at, you know, to research three or four. So they'll have one lead sort of product, and they'll take this through clinical trials. There's three phases in clinical trials, and that clinical means it goes into it's tested on humans, basically, and it's tested for safety, efficacy, and it's phase one, phase two, phase three. And it's very expensive, and each phase can take a year or more. So it's a long time, very expensive. There's no revenue coming in during this time at all. They may get a JV partner to stump up some cash, but at the end of phase three, when it passes all the tests, which took a long time, very expensive, then it goes to commercialization, and they can obviously reap in the rewards. It can be a blockbuster drug, billions of, and lots of, most companies do that, have that model. C4XD don't have that model. And what they've got, they don't have, you know, one drug. They don't have two or three or four or five or six or seven or eight or nine. They have 10 drugs ready to go. Now, this is preclinical. This is even before phase one, two, and three. So they're not going to even go into that expensive phase. So what you do with preclinical, you test in vitro. This means in test tubes, all that. You use genetic models, super high data crunching software. So you test it. You make sure it works pretty much to a certain level, you know. And then it has to go through the phase three clinical studies to prove it works at a safety and efficacious level. So they will not go into that level of the very expensive level. Now, they've already done, the one drug they've done, I can't remember the name of it, but it's anti-addiction, is for opioids, any kind of addiction. And they've just done a deal last week with, and I find it hard to say this company's name, is Indivivia, Indiviva. Anyway, it's a spin-out from Reckitt-Benckiser. They're a FTSE 250 company. Now, they paid C4XD $10 million up front, and the entire package is worth $294 million if they take this through the clinical trials. And so this is a market cap of $45 million in pound company, you know? So that is worth them, over the next few years, $300 million. You think, wow. Obviously, they have to hit certain milestones, but they've already tested the drug, and they're very happy with it. And the guy, the CEO, Clive Dix, I spoke to on the phone on Friday. And I said, I love what you're doing. I said, listen, Clive, I'll explain. The missus is away with the kids for the week. I'm on my own in the house. I just spent all evening just looking at the videos of your company and researching it. And I love what you're doing. You've sort of broken the mold. You say, yeah, I know. I don't know anyone sort of doing what we're doing. Clive's got an amazing track record. The last two investments he did before he joined C4XD, one he bought like $30 million in the city and did it like sevenfold increase. And the other one was around about the same, you know, multiple return on 30 million. And he said, I know how to create value in drug discoveries, and this is what I'm doing with CX4. And he says, you've got to watch this video presentation. I'll write a blog about it on the weekend. He says at the end, he's very bold. He said, I know we can do this. And this sort of deal we've done now with Indivivo has validated it. And they expect, they've got 10 almost ready to go. Every year they'll have four ready to go with partners. So this means potentially four deals of that magnitude, 300 million every year, even if they get one away, which is phenomenal. It's like a game of numbers. So they've really cut on the risk here, and they've got sort of proprietary, sort of cutting edge technology testing these drugs. And if you just, I just listened to their interim report, they did a conference call, and they're so bullish on three others at the moment that they think they're very close to JV partnering on. It may take the rest of the year, but I just think it's a phenomenal. It's like a conveyor belt of drug development on steroids. You know.
How are they paying for that?
They've got the various cash. I mean, first of all, the interim show at the end of the, I think it was the end of January or something. Let me just check when the interims are up. But they've got 10 million in cash. So that's the first thing. They are non-revenue generating at the moment. But they've now got that $10 million in cash for 7 million. They had a 1.7 million tax sort of incentive given to them, and they had 1.4 in the bank. So they've got about 11 million in cash. Clive said that'll take us for the next 12 months. And by that time, we'll hope to sign another deal by then. But this is not how normal companies do it. And Clive realised this, and he went into this because he said, "This, I don't want to do it in the normal. I don't want to take one drug." And listen, with these small companies, if that one drug fails, you know, phase one, two, or three, it'll crater them. They'll go through. That's how risky. And you can liken sort of these small biotech companies to sort of exploration companies. So you've got three phases there, pretty much. Exploration, where they go around trying to find some kind of mineralization. They explore. Then they start doing assays or soil samples. Then they drill a little bit, trying to keep the cost down. And they drill a bit more, they find some mineralization. Then they try and, you know, drill more, and try and define that size of resource and the grade of the resource. And they get to the stage where they create a JORC resource, which is a standard. They go about drilling in a certain way. It's a standardized, recognized globally, recognized size. And they prove that in exploration. Then they take that to a bank of a feasibility study, and they say, okay, can we have some money? Then they go to development. And so it's for exploration, development, and that's developing the mine. That's a lot of money, of course. And then it goes to producing what they've discovered. So that's three phases. So you can liken it to that. It's very, at the start, very high risk. There's no guarantee you'll find mineralization, or there's no guarantee you'll find a drug that works. But if you do start doing it, testing it, you start doing these initial drill results, and we've got something here, then the value creation from preclinical to commercial is massive, absolutely massive. And Clive realised that's where the value creation happens. The massive value creation happens when you've got nothing, pretty much. You do tests on data sets, on genetics. So they're testing basically genes on genes data sets in the lab before it gets into clinical trials. It's preclinical. That means it's not in humans. It's in vitro, which is in test tubes and stuff. But they pretty much know how it works. But they've got also two bits, and it's worth reading. It's a lot of stuff on this. But they've got two bits of amazing software and models that work better. Do you know what? I don't want to go into too much depth.
Sounds like you're pretty positive about this.
I don't want to go into too much depth in this, but do you know what? I forget the numbers. Do you know what? I get it now. There was something like they were like, they're looking at Parkinson's. They only target diseases that have a massive unmet need. So there's a massive need for it. And for like for example, addiction. Apparently worth about $13 billion every year. Parkinson's disease, another one. There's
colds.
Everything. A limp. cold thing.
Athlete's foot.
Yeah, athlete's foot. That kind of stuff. In fact, that's probably is quite big. But so they only target massive, things. But they're. It's hard to say how cutting edge their software stuff is as well, their genetic modelling is. And when I read through, they're looking at Parkinson's disease, right? And there's only some, forgive me for the numbers in this, because I'm trying to find out where it is, but there's only about 30 known genes that are associated with Parkinson's disease. They've discovered another 180. So they've discovered more than the world has known. I mean, it sounds like too good to be true, but if you look at the credentials of the management, you realise they aren't lying. And so that's how good they are. So
where are they based?
They're spun out of the University of Manchester, but they're based in Manchester, and they've got an office in London as well. But two technology platforms there is called Taxonomy 3R and Conformetrics. And it's really, I was trying to get my head around reading it. They've got these models that can determine the shape of the drugs, the 3D shapes of drugs that need to attach to certain diseases. And they've got the software that can capable of analysing six disease data sets a year genetically. It's really complex. I'm trying to get my head around it. But at the end of the day, the guy's there. It's a phenomenal. He said, we are a disruptor in the traditional model of biotech companies. And like I said, they're valued at 40 million, 45 million. They've got 10, 11 million in cash. So I just think they've done a deal with, 300 million with Indivivar, which is a spin out from Reckitt Benckiser, which is 5250. And I really like them. But I mean, do your own research. I may be wrong. And at the moment, like I said, we don't know when news is next. It may be a while, so the share price may dwindle for a while. I bought it at 102. It did dwindle. On that day, they had the interims out. And of course, last week, when they announced that deal, it gapped up. It was the day before, it was 56 pence. They announced that deal, went to £1.50. It came back down, people were buying it, £1.50. And then a couple of days later, it came down a bit. The interims came out, and they came back on that interims. I don't know why they came back, but I bought them. They were about 4% down, but that was still at £1.2. They went up for the day, then they went down on Friday. So they are now, down at 98. And they may dwindle for a while, because like I say, it's all about news on AIM, you know? It's not about revenue and profit. So it may dwindle for a while. But this is the time you should do your research and look at them. And the video, I'll write the blog on the weekend. Subscribe to my newsletter if you want. But the videos. Clive, at the end of the video, I like it. He said, this is my swan song. He's worked for Glaxo. He's worked for all the big companies. He sold to Pfizer. But he said he knows all the heads of R&D and all the big pharma companies. They're having discussions now on three other drugs. But he said, this is my swan song, and I want to make this company the best. In fact, do you know what? This is how much I liked it. I liked it so much, I transcribed the video. I took all the it cost me about 13 quid, and I transcribed it. There we go. He ends with this. This is my big swan song. I'm going to make this really work. It's going to be the best UK biotech ever. That's my ambition. There we are.
So let me ask you a question then that's sort of based on that. So I was mentioning in the week to you about Immu Pharma and how I feel far more happy and far more interested in investing in companies like Immu Pharma. Mate, I'll take a look at C4XD, the other one, Hemogenics as well, which also sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Companies which are trying to change the world for the better is a nice way to invest your money, so long as you can get a return on it as well. You tweet quite a lot about sort of animal welfare and elephants and that sort of stuff. You're clearly quite
into.
I can't
remember the last time I tweeted an elephant. Yeah, no,
you're always tweeting about elephants and rhinos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yet you also invest in lots of resources companies, which are doing their best to tear up the environments where those animals live. How do you play the ethics off against your investments, or do you
not?
Well, first of all, no company, right, in this world, unless they're in a sort of like in Syria or something like that, no company in this world would get permission to tear up the land where elephants are. They would not get permission. I mean, when a company goes through planning for a mine, they have to go through all kinds, and the feasibility study covers everything from environment to water, because mines need a lot of water, all that kind of stuff. And unless it meets with certain standards, they will not get permission for a mine. It's very strict. You can't just build a mine anywhere. I mean, I understand.
I'm sure in some jurisdictions, there's a bit of flexibility there. There's probably a little bit of money that can exchange hands to help things along.
Well, you'd be surprised these days. There's a lot of international pressure, and I think you'd be surprised how. I do sometimes say this. I see an area of natural beauty there, and then you think it's going to be torn up for for some kind of resort. But generally, honestly, yeah. But there are some jurisdictions you stay out of, but. Honestly, the feasibility studies and all that stuff, they are, they have to tick several boxes. It's not a box ticking exercise. I mean, the environmental studies they have to go through, and just read them. If you go look at something like Horizonte Minerals, for example, in Brazil, right, if you read about the environmental impact assessment, and Talao Energy and Asia Met, they've got environmental impact assessments that have to be passed by government bodies. And they're very thorough. You can't, they're not going to sort of remove an indigenous tribe just to get some copper out of the ground. It's not going to happen. And they're not going to get rid of some elephants or poor donkeys. It doesn't happen. It's got to be, there's a fine way up between the financial benefit and the environmental cost. So, I know what you're saying. I do feel that every day. I tweeted even yesterday. I mean, it's a video just retweeted about cow's milk. And I bang on about this. I don't drink cow's milk anymore. And I felt, for as long as I can remember, we've all been told that cow's milk is good for us. And generally, nutritionally, it's questionably good. It's not that good for us, pretty much. There's other alternatives better. But morally, it's really bad. And yet, we've always been told this lovely dairy industry. Are you kidding? It's not. They impregnate the cows several times, get rid of the calf, kill it, pretty much, and get the milk out for the humans. And cows are not unintelligent. They do know they've given birth, and there is a bonding thing that happens there, and it's awful. And we've been sold this for want of a better word, brainwashed for so many years about cow's milk. It's not that good for us, and it's a morally bankrupt industry. It's horrible. But there we go. But yeah, I am sort of, I do weigh that up, and I think I'm right for you. Do you know what? I may start that way, but I may go down that way, tech and biotech. and start edging away from resources. But in the meantime, no! No, because honestly, just read through an environmental impact assessment. And it's not only that, they have to do all kinds of things to the local community. So I know Horizonte, you have to get in thing. They've set up charities, local charities, they've helped local schools, and that's the sell-off. They have to do that. I mean, it's not, and you think, when I first started investing, I started reading that, I thought, why are they wasting their money on that? And you realise it's part of the deal. They have to revitalise the economy or the environment they're in. And there's, if you look at like HZM, which we're in, is you know a very good company. It's at almost pre-feasibility studies. They've done all kinds of local, incentives. They've helped little schools. They've all done so. They do put good back into the community. You know, it's not just money. There is a lot of environmental sort of upside there. So yeah, so read into it. So it's not all bad. I mean, you know, this is. Well, let's be honest. We're in 2018. Maybe back in this it was 70s. Maybe that would have happened. Maybe there are some parts of the world right now that happens. But the majority of places, you know, it's all, you can't just do that. You can't just rip up sort of a place of environmental beauty and just crack on with it. It doesn't happen, but hopefully anyway. But just read through. It's worth reading through some of the environmental reports. They are quite in-depth, you know, and they have to do a lot of stuff. Talking about that, FCR.
Hey, always coming back to.
No, two bits of news: Upland Resources, right, and FCR. So, did you see Upland? Are you in Upland, Baddy? Yep. Yeah. So, I don't think people understand the significance of that. We've been waiting for a long time for this. Now, Sarawak people, I understand. There's been a memorandum of understanding signed with the Sarawak Council, right? And Sarawak is part of Malaysia, it's a state in Malaysia, but. They've wanted their independence for a long time because they don't see themselves as Malaysians or Sarawakans. And so they're almost like... I've spoken to Steve Staley, actually, and he said to me, I suppose the best way of framing it is like Scotland in this country. You've got the North Sea, full of oil, or was full of oil, still is full of oil, but not as easy accessible. And, you know, Scottish people who work in the industry up there, they feel it's off their coast... But yet the whole country benefits, and that's the same with Malaysia. But so the Sarawakans have been given, but there's been the Malaysians that sort of appeased them in sort of way, and they said, okay, you can have rights to that. So the Sarawak estate has set up their own company, and it's right next to Brunei. And you know, the Sultan of Brunei is one of the richest guys in the world. He's one of the richest guys in the world because of oil and gas. There's massive gas and oil reserves off their coast there in Sarawak. And I was just reading some stats here. According to the Malaysian Energy Hub, the state accounts for half of the country's proven natural gas reserves. And possesses around 30% of its known 5.85 billion barrels of oil reserves. So there's a lot there. And this is Ian Lowe, chairman of Shell Malaysia. And he said, up until 3 or 4 years ago, the prospect of finding new oil discoveries in Malaysia appeared limited. But discoveries in the past 12 months, particularly in Sarawak, indicate there may still be a lot more discoveries to come. And... when you get someone from Shell saying a lot more discoveries to come, Shell's a massive company. It's a major. When they say a lot more to come, that means a lot. It's not, you know, and yet you've got 11 million market cap company like Upland Resources, who've just done a deal with, you know, they're the only, in the oil and gas, the only company that's done a private company that's done a deal with the a government. And that's huge. That is huge. Then you add on to the fact they've got the backers from like, you know, Tony Fernandez, who's a multi-millionaire, and he was the Asian version of Apprentice, like Alan Sugar and Trump was, you know, behind this, put money into this company. And you think, wow, this is nuts. And they've got other things going on as well. So they've got the WIC prospect in this country. They're doing North Africa very soon. They're obviously going through talks in North Africa. So I think, you know, people have not seen this, Upland Resources, and not realised how big that news is. But I think it's massive news. But, so I think there's much more upside there. And in fact, right, reading here, much of Malaysia's future production activity will be concentrated within Sibar and Sarawak's offshore basins. So that's where all the stuff is. That's where it all is. And yet, you know, Upland has been given the key by the government there of Sarawak, which is phenomenal.
So I keep on waiting for a down day with them, but there hasn't been one for a long time.
Lots
of level days. But there's not been a big readjustment or a downward day, really.
Yeah,
should I continue to wait or
just
get in?
There'll always be a downward day. Into stocks, you wait. There'll be, it's like, I don't know how to explain it, but you know, when the news is released, like we said earlier, when the news is released, it's very hot, isn't it? The stocks are very hot, and people jump in. You want to be the opposite of that. You want to be. And when people talk about contrarian, I'm a contrarian investor, and that doesn't mean just going buying rubbish that no one else wants. A contrarian investor is like Warren Buffett has always said. You know, literally, you buy when others are fearful, and you sell when others are greedy. And there's a good reason for that. It's because, you know, the crowd generally in the stock market can be wrong. They help momentum, but not everyone can be right. And it's only the few that are good. So, yeah, it'll have a down day. And I waited. Listen, I saw C4XD, right? I saw that rally from, like I said, it opened, it gapped up. The day before was at 50 pence, and it's gone up to 150. And I thought, this is going to be a 10-bagger overnight. This is. And I was having fear of missing out there. And I waited. And I thought, no, I'm not going to get in. If I miss out, I miss out. And next couple of days down to just below a pound. I thought, excellent. So at least it has doubled from the previous thing, but it's not tripled. So, and I thought, it's 45 million market cap. They've done a deal worth $300 million. They do one of those a year, and they're starting this year. Their production line starts this year. They'll be having four products every year up for partnerships. So they do one of those out of four every year. I think 40 million, and they got 11 million in cash. It's nothing, you know? So I just held back and bought on a down day. And it ended up, in fact, the day I bought on it, ended up. So, there will be a time to buy. All shares got them down, you know? So, and it's that will make the difference in the long term. That kind of that psychology you have, hardwiring yourself into going against the market, I think will help you better in the long term for, you know, better returns, rather than just jumping on the bandwagon. Wait for a down day. Okay, Steve, any thoughts, Steve?
No thoughts.
I just had a text from Pete right now, a WhatsApp picture in Wales. I think he's cycling across Wales, obviously. I see it's hills. It's lovely weather there, what some clouds and blue sky. Who'd want to be doing that? I'd much prefer to be talking about stocks. he's raising money. Yeah, stocks and war. What better is there? So, Steve, why did you... Before we go into anything, Steve, why did you go out last night with Cam there? Steve's out with Cam, and we both... In fact, Paddy, you lived with Cam, didn't you?
Yeah.
Was that a good experience?
It was... Yeah, it was fine.
I remember one. Cam's a bit of a party animal, Steve, isn't he?
Well, not so much these days, but probably back in his day he was, yeah.
I remember once, Cam used to do early morning breakfast on Capital Radio, just before we used to go, our show used to go on Capital Radio. And I remember once, you know, he had to get up, you know, he had to start at like something like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, was it? No, but 4 o'clock in the morning he had to start, didn't he? So he had to get up like 3 in the morning. Anyway, we'd been out on the piss, I shouldn't swear there, but we were out drinking. And then we went back to your place, Pat, in Camden. And Cam was in bed, and we got back quite late, about 12 or something like that. And he got up and said, "Hey, all right," went straight to the fridge and got a can of lager out. He'd been sleeping there for like a couple of hours. I thought, what? He was almost snapped into party mode. It was no, you know, what are you guys, turn the lights off, what's going on? It was any of that. Just really snapped in, he's almost such a switch in his back, party. And yet he had to be at work in a couple of hours. That is nuts, isn't it? Is he still a bit like that, Steve?
Well, no. Well, we went out for beers yesterday afternoon, and he was in bed by 9:30, so...
Is he? Oh, okay, he's worn out. Yeah.
Budweiser still.
Yeah, still Budweiser.
Wow, I always remember that. I thought that was amazing. Literally, party mode! To him, that was the best, you know, thing that ever happened. Some guys come into his house really drinking. All right, a ready-made party in his house, in his flat. Okay, so one more thing on to mention FCR, you know... The strategy here is the general meeting is coming up, of course. There will be new shares issued to raise that £1 million gross. The amount of shares been issued to the market is about a third of what's already out there. So there'll probably be a bit of a flipping because people will make a quick sort of profit, and so there'll be maybe a bit of downward pressure on the share price. I intend to sort of top up them as well. But yesterday, Lawrence went crazy on Vox, tweeting out...
Oh, mate, it's much, isn't it? He needs to calm down.
I love Lawrence. Lawrence is very excited about the project. He's one of these guys that gets very excited, very enthusiastic. He just tweets. He found out that Alpha Zinc, which is a company in Europe, so the jurisdiction is very similar. It's an explorer of zinc, and they've got like a resource of 3 million tonnes. Ferrum Crescent have a resource of 16 million tonnes. So Alpha Zinc have been given a strategic investment from a company. This is how he put it, with a group with significant provenance, Western Mining. So this company have ploughed in $3 million for a 20% stake in Alta Zinc, Alta Zinc, called. And their resource is 3.3 million tons. So if you do the maths here and work it out, pretty much Ferrum Crescent's resource is about five times the size. And so that equivalent would be putting 14.5 million. I mean, you can't do like for like, but it's in Europe, it's zinc, you know, and it's pretty similar, apart from our FCR resource is bigger. So that would be 14.5 million investment in FCR. And if that's 20%, then that would value FCR at $72.5 million. At the moment, I think, what are they valued at? So like 2 million? 2.5 million? So you can see, when you're looking at stocks here, don't worry about share price so much. Look at the value. Look at 2.5 million. There will be an extra million coming in, obviously, or gross, when that thing is. So 3.5 million with cash, but you can assume the share price will go down a little bit. But when you look at investing companies, try and assess value, not share price, value generation. And you can see the value generation there should be quite significant. So on any metric, we've seen comparisons with other peers before, but on any metric, you know, you've got to think, well, hang on, why is it so undervalued? It's in Spain. It's in an area of natural beauty. There's lovely elephants and tigers.
Perfect. And, yeah. Rip it up.
Just get rid of those. And also, like I said, Lawrence was on Vox recently doing pictures of a zinc mine a couple of miles away from Torral, and taking pictures of Torral, which is where the FCR resource is. And that's, I mean, if you didn't know nothing about geology and resource companies, geology is everything. So essentially, you know, if you got a zinc mine a couple of miles away, there's a good chance there's zinc mineralization where you are, you know. So, but
particularly liked his pictures of the JCBs.
Yeah, it was a bit. Oh, my phone was buzzing constantly all week, and every time it was a picture of that field from guy in Spain.
Yeah, I did say that, and I said, Lawrence, you got, you know, I said you got about 700 followers on Vox. Every time you send a tweet, it pings their phone. It's a very powerful notification. It's very powerful indeed. But it can get on people's nerves.
But if it's a photo of a hedge, I'm not interested.
You understand, geologists and people like that love that kind of stuff. They'd love it. It's like anything that shows a bit of mineralization in the rock. Do you remember, Pat? I remember going, when I first went to Capital Radio, and Chris Tarrant was the breakfast show, and Johnny Vaughan was taking over, and we were starting to work on Johnny Vaughan's show. I sort of helped tech up a little bit, or helped with Adrian. Do you remember the engineer Adrian? Who used to, what's his name? Yeah. But he's an engineer, really anoraki engineer, and he'd just come back from holidays, right? He went to Cyprus or something, and he showed me some of the pictures on his phone, and there were 30 pictures of aerial masts or transmitter masts in Cyprus, a little island with millions of them on. And he said, I've got to show this to the engineering boys, this is amazing. I thought, what on earth? And the engineer, they're all around there. The Indian guy there, and they were looking at it like they were looking at porn. Couldn't believe it. And I thought, these are like transmitters. And so you have to understand, geologists are a bit the same. They get very excited when they're walking around Torral looking at things, looking at all the zinc mines. They're loving it. It's better than porn to them. They're loving it, you know? So I love that kind of enthusiasm, but he doesn't understand that not everyone as an investor shares enthusiasm for rock as they do. It's more returns rather than rock. Anyway, I think we've chatted. I've chatted enough anyway. Any other questions, Pad, you got? Steve?
No, I'm out.
No, I think we leave it for this week. Plenty of that.
Thanks, Steve. Plenty there.
That's all right.
We covered everything.
It was all good. Just enough.
Did you understand anything about what I said about C4XD? Do you understand why it's different compared to other models? Does that make sense or not?
Yeah, no, it does a bit. You're breaking up a little bit. My Wi-Fi is a bit rubbish here, so I was only getting bits and bobs of the story.
You have no idea what I was banging on about. You guys, I was talking about some technical stuff for like half an hour. No idea what you're talking about, but I hung in there. Thanks, Just. Brilliant. I love that.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. Thanks for that, Steve. That's good.
It was good to hear your voice.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Pad, thanks for coming in, our fella, at short notice. What's your plans for today, Pad? Are you going to watch the Grand National?
No, I'm sticking up a fence, and then I'm going to the Spurs match.
Oh, I see. Who's Spurs playing?
Man City.
Oh, I'm watching the Spurs now. My sons are at the Spurs now. They're Tottenham because Megan's father is obviously North London area. He's a Spurs fan, big Spurs fan, season ticket holder. And so the kids now, they're not. Megan's WhatsApp sort of FaceTiming me from Fuerteventura, and the kids are this morning playing football in their Spurs kits. But
wonderful.
Yeah, marvellous stuff, and have a nice day, guys. I'm going to write a blog. I'm going to write a blog on a certain company I may have mentioned in the podcast. Can you guess what it is?
Cool.
All right, see you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
The Weekend Podcast on Vox Markets with Justin, Peter and Steve. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.